You heard that terrible economic number this morning, right? No, not that really bad one, the other really bad one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 30th of July. Good, it's always to have you along, everybody. So this was a big and not great day in the American economy, but not, I fear, for the reason a lot of people are saying that this was a big and not great day in the American economy. Yes, we got that dismal and completely expected number on second quarter economic growth, of which there was none, as you know, by this point in the day. The economy shrank 9.5% April through June, almost 33% if you annualize that number. We've been over that, right? Annualization? You remember that? Okay. We also got, because this is Thursday, our regular report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits. They were up from a week ago. More than 1.4 million people applied for government help because they lost their jobs. Also not great. But the actual not great number that for my money is the biggie today is something known as continuing claims, the number of people filing for unemployment for at least the second week in a row. More than 17 million people in today's report. Here's economist Tara Sinclair at George Washington University.
Continued claims becomes more noticeable when they not just rise, but when they persist.
And persist they have, above 15 million since the middle of April, which tells us...
It tells us about where we are in the economic cycle. If we were really seeing a very robust recovery with lots of new job options for people, we would expect to see the continued claims dropping.
Which they are not.
And that's a really discouraging sign for economic recovery.
Why? Because those continuing claims can turn into permanent job losses. And permanent job losses are exactly what Jay Powell is talking about when he talks, as he always does, about this crisis doing long-term damage to this economy. Our thanks, as always, to Tara Sinclair at George Washington for helping us out. If you happen to have been listening yesterday, and if not, why not, or this morning, if you so choose, if you were listening, you heard Jay Powell say this about this economy.
Fundamentally, this is a disinflationary shock.
Disinflation. Not deflation, but disinflation. I took a quick pass at this on the fly yesterday, but it needs a little extra time, which we have given to Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
I am live on the scene, ladies and gentlemen. I'm on the corner of 50th and 10th in Manhattan. I'm outside of this ramen restaurant looking at their menu, and longtime diner and my roommate, Meng Chi, is here. Meng, can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, so the ramen went up by $3.
How does that make you feel? You must be devastated.
I guess so.
So what about other restaurants? What has happened there?
They say it about the same.
Unbelievable. Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Meng, thank you so much for your service.
So it turns out that disinflation looks kind of like inflation. That's because disinflation is inflation, just less of it on average.
So disinflation is a slowing of the inflation rate.
Alan Detmeister, economist with UBS. So inflation is still happening overall, just not as much. Because while that restaurant's prices are going up on 10th Avenue, prices are coming down over on 9th Avenue. That's where you'll find Darius Glover. He's a personal trainer with GloverFit.com. He trains his clients outside now.
Without the amenities and all the equipment I would have normally at my facilities, I lowered it, my rates, 20, 30%.
Prices in the U.S. fell in March, April, and May, but they're turning around. And over the past year, prices are still rising. Slowing inflation is different from deflation.
So deflation is something serious.
Marcus Brunemeyer is a professor at Princeton University. Deflation is sustained falling of overall prices over months, even years. It squeezes companies and makes it harder to pay off old debts.
And that makes bankruptcy levels go up and so forth. And that makes then the whole economy go down.
That is not where we are at. The drops in prices look pretty temporary and not pervasive. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
I could use some ramen, I'll tell you that. All right, there is more negotiating set for tonight on Capitol Hill over the next economic rescue package. Unemployment benefits are still on the table. Some kind of PPP extension probably as well. Not clear, though, whether there's going to be anything for state and local governments, which are facing revenue gaps and increased demand for social services. States, unlike the feds, generally can't run deficits to cover spending, so cuts in services and public employee layoffs are real possibilities, and that would hit some groups especially hard. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Lee Saunders, the president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, comes from a long line of public employees.
My father, my mother, they were public sector workers. My dad was a city bus driver, and that was a way back then when I was growing up in Cleveland for African-American families to move into the middle class.
The mostly union jobs of the public sector provided solid wages, good benefits, and a level of job security that was tough to find elsewhere. In the 1960s and 70s, anti-discrimination and affirmative action policies boosted government employment of women and people of color, a trend that persists today. John Schmidt is the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute.
The public sector disproportionately employs workers that have historically had more trouble in the labor market due to issues around discrimination.
Black and women workers are still overrepresented in state and local government jobs. The sector also serves as an important pipeline for veterans, 1 in 8 of whom currently work in local public service. Major job cuts in the sector would affect those populations acutely. We already saw this play out during the Great Recession.
We never caught up again, so we have a huge gap.
Sylvia Allegretto with UC Berkeley's Center of Wage and Employment Dynamics says the lingering effects of those cuts to jobs and resources in local services, like, say, public health departments, are now compounding the health and economic crisis. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, ugly early, then less ugly later. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So you know how everybody's been saying when school starts in the fall, as we have those conversations about what school is going to look like? In some parts of the country, fall is already here. A lot of districts in Tennessee start classes next week. And with the virus on the rise there and in so many other places, teachers are worried about going back to the classroom. Real worried. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
This summer, Jake Wilson read everything he intended to assign his 8th grade English class, including A Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare, his favorite.
Right up until 2.5 weeks ago, I was all set to start the new year.
Then his school district, just outside Nashville, decided teachers and students would not have to wear masks. Wilson and his wife started thinking the district wasn't taking the pandemic seriously enough, and they have a 2-year-old with asthma. So just 2 weeks before school started, Wilson left his teaching career to be a stay-at-home dad.
I can't imagine not looking out at a class of, 13 and 14-year-olds. But I also can't imagine getting my kids sick and seeing them in the hospital and that being my fault. So I while it was a hard decision, it also wasn't a hard decision at all.
As he was cleaning out his classroom at Ellis Middle School in Hendersonville, he says several colleagues told him they shared his fears but didn't feel they could quit. While kids have tended to fare much better with COVID-19, the adults in schools have cause for concern, says Jen Cates of the Kaiser Family Foundation.
We found 1.5 million teachers, or 1 in 4, would be at greater risk of serious illness or even death if they were to become infected.
Cates says political leaders and even medical professionals have been overly focused on what's best for children, which might be a return to in-person school. Cates, who has a kindergartner, says heading back to class would be good for her too.
As much as I would like my kid to be back in school, I am quite concerned about what it might mean for teachers.
There are more dramatic calls to put off in-person classes until COVID-19's under control. In Nashville, a few dozen teachers in their minivans drove through town in a mock funeral procession In Florida, some educators are writing living wills before going back to class. Many of the efforts are coordinated with teachers' unions that have been asking that in-person classes not return until communities have no new cases for 14 days. Rural Marshall County, Tennessee, is a long way from that benchmark. So first-grade teacher Kristen Morgel says she's still not sure she'll return to the classroom when her district resumes.
I have no desire to leave the profession. I'm not looking to quit. It's something that I've put my heart and soul into for 10 years, and I plan to do until retirement. But I am looking at a short-term leave just to protect my health, the health of my family.
It's not exactly an economy where you'd want to give up a steady job, but that could change once teachers get back in front of students. It did for Amanda Strawn. She's a pre-K teaching assistant in another Nashville suburb who returned to work in May. Then her classroom got its first confirmed case of COVID-19 at the end of June. The student showed up with a fever and was sent home, but it took 2 weeks for test results to come back, all while the student's siblings kept coming.
We needed to let all the parents know right away. We needed to let all the employees know right away. The whole hallway should have been shut down for 2 weeks.
The district's nursing coordinator says she would have done more contact tracing, but the contagious period had already passed. The school did send a letter home to classmates, though not in the siblings' classes. And in Strawn's view, the letter downplayed the risks.
We as a society are not going to get through this pandemic if we're not honest with each other. We're just not.
Strawn took a day off, then decided to give up her job. She says having policies meant to protect students and teachers is one thing, but following them will be the hard part. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When you pull this rug out from under people, it's not just about their living or dying in that moment.
It's kind of about the aftermath of that moment as well, actually. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 225 points today, 0.8%, closed at 26,313. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ gained 44 points, about 0.4%, 10,587. The S&P 500 down 12, a 1/3%, 32.46. More coronavirus vaccine news today. Johnson & Johnson is launching a human study of its most promising potential vaccine after it proved effective as a single dose administered to monkeys. The U.S. government spending nearly $500 million to help the company with its research. Shares up slightly today, just 0.2%. AstraZeneca says it's gotten protection in most countries from liability lawsuits about its vaccine as it develops. AstraZeneca shares banked 2.2% today. Still days in the summertime when you want to go for a drive, but gas prices are creeping up. AAA says the price of regular gasoline is up more than a cent from last month on average, sitting at $2.19 a gallon, but that is down 53 cents a gallon from a year ago. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Professional basketball is back tonight, but it's going to look a little different than it did when last games were played. That would be back in March. There's going to be social distancing on the bench, no home court advantage, cocooned as the 22 NBA teams are in their Disney World bubble in Central Florida. Just the costs of that, the isolation, the testing, the whole thing, is $170 million. So Marketplace's Erica Barris has more now on the economics of the NBA in its coronavirus season.
Keeping the players satisfied while they're in the bubble? Not easy. So says Dave Barry, a sports economics professor at Southern Utah University, because players are used to making their own choices. But
now you're centralizing everything. So it's one NBA making the decision.
About everything from the blankets in the hotel rooms, not long enough, to the food. Players made fun of meals on social media and asked why the owner of the Houston Rockets got a catering contract. Here's J.R. Smith of the L.A. Lakers in an Instagram video a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been dope to get some of these black restaurants in surrounding Orlando area.
The NBA seems to be listening to what its players want. The league didn't get back to us before deadline, but it's supporting players as they bring Black Lives Matter messages to the game. Meanwhile, the players feel empowered. Courtney Cox at the University of Oregon studies identity representation in sports media. She says now the players are saying,
everything we do can be more intentional,
including encouraging the league to spend bubble cash in the community. Last week, an NBA official showed up to offer a catering contract at Shauna's Caribbean and Soul Food restaurant in Orlando. It's owned by Joshua Johnson, a 31-year-old black man who says he's an even bigger NBA fan now.
Everything that's going on, not every organization has done this.
And in this economic climate, the newfound attention is welcome, says Johnson. Just yesterday, 8 people came in and asked for exactly what LeBron ordered: salmon, greens, and mac and cheese. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
You want to see a doctor right now for standard stuff, office visit, nothing critical. Chances are real good you're going to be doing it at a distance, over video or on the phone. Telehealth like that isn't new. Some healthcare professionals have been pushing it for decades, especially so that people who live in rural parts of the country can have access to care. And obviously the virus is driving things now. But is it going to last? From the Mountain West News Bureau, Madeline Beck reports.
Treasure Valley Dermatology is a relatively new clinic in Boise, Idaho. But it's only within the last few months that the clinic has started seeing patients over a screen.
Telehealth was something that we got into when the COVID pandemic really started to hit the area.
That's dermatologist Dustin Portella. He says that his profession requires a lot of in-person exams, but it's worked great for following up with patients.
We found that we can really keep patients out of the clinic when they don't need to be here to provide reassurance if they have a quick concern.
So far, Portella says between 15 and 20% of the clinic's patients have used it, and they're not alone. Telehealth has boomed for everything from physical therapy to counseling during the pandemic, even in rural states like Idaho.
We've done 10 years of telehealth adoption in 3 months.
That's Idaho Department of Health and Welfare Director Dave Jepson. He says there was a nearly 4,000% increase in telehealth claims just with Medicaid patients in Idaho.
March, April, and May of 2019, across all of Medicaid, we had about 3,000 telehealth visits that took place. And for that same time period here of 2020, we had 117,500 telehealth claims.
To allow that expansion, federal and state governments temporarily rolled back dozens of regulations around Medicare and Medicaid, prescription access, and they allowed telehealth to be provided over non-HIPAA-compliant platforms like Zoom. But now that so many people use telehealth, lawmakers don't want to go back to the way it was before. In Idaho, Governor Brad Little recently signed an executive order that makes his state's telehealth changes permanent.
This step should help preserve these healthcare advances long after COVID-19.
More than 300 organizations have written to Congress urging it to make the changes permanent, too. Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander urged caution around privacy and security during a recent Senate committee hearing, but he was one of the many lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who agreed that they should keep some changes.
And we should do so while the experiences still are fresh on everyone's minds.
There was especially support for Medicare and Medicaid covering more telehealth services and covering people in more areas. But for telehealth to continue at this level in the future, private insurance companies have to be on board, too.
It provides great options and great opportunities for people, but it also raises a number of questions about quality of care, about access, about connectivity.
That's John Worley with Blue Cross of Idaho. Historically, private insurance companies haven't reimbursed for a range of telehealth services that can be provided over video or phone, like monitoring homebound patients or providing counseling for patients with chronic conditions, or even to help with behavioral health disorders like addiction. But Blue Cross of Idaho is covering those kinds of services now because of the pandemic. It's maintaining telehealth coverage until the end of the year and likely beyond that.
We will continue to provide these services into the future and provide access.
At the moment, many insurers are paying the same amount for video visits as for office visits, just as Medicaid has been doing. But insurers will likely reevaluate that and consider paying less. How much those insurers pay will determine who can afford it. And for some patients, there will still be hurdles beyond insurance and regulations, like access to the internet at all. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
The first week in November 2018, November the 8th, to be exact, the town of Paradise, California, was destroyed by wildfire. The campfire, as it was called, was one of the biggest, and it was the deadliest wildfire in California's history. 85 people were killed, 50,000 people were displaced. And the question, or one of many way, and one of the dilemmas coming out of it, was all about rebuilding paradise. Ron Howard, yes, that Ron Howard, has a new documentary out tomorrow about exactly that question. It is called Rebuilding Paradise. Mr. Howard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be heard.
Yeah, that's right. Why'd you want to make this documentary?
Well, I've been really enjoying delving into the documentary medium for the last few years. And I wanted to find a subject that was personal to me. And when the fire in Paradise occurred, that was a town that I knew. My mother-in-law had lived there. I'd visited in the last few years of her life. I'd visited there many times. And suddenly there was something personal going on. And I just wondered, you know, what rebuilding Paradise might actually entail, if it was even possible. And we just began.
Okay, so to this film, and your personal ties to Paradise. It's a little bit brutal. The first 8 minutes are the fire itself told through, obviously, footage that you and your staff went out to get. I guess the opening question is, what was it like for you to get up there after the fire and look around?
Well, I'd never been, around anything like that. That sort of total devastation. And that in and of itself was shocking to the nervous system. And then to see and begin to interview people who, had experienced the rug completely pulled out from under them, what was going to be left for them. And that became our story. And it's also something that they wanted to talk about. They wanted to share that footage. They wanted people to understand that as we saw these individuals make some pretty remarkable decisions and take these steps toward actually trying to rebuild their lives and this community, we would never forget that, you know, in their recent past was this harrowing experience.
Yeah, the last scene in that opening 8.5 minutes is a family in a car, the dad pointing out, you know, and it's 11:30 in the morning in Paradise. There's this fire. It's black as night. And then the dad says in this car, there's blue sky. There's blue sky. And you can hear, and I can't tell whether it's the mom or his wife or one of the kids crying and saying that they want to get as far away from Paradise as possible. And there's a little metaphorical thing going on there, right? Because so much of what's happening now with the people of Paradise is the Paradise diaspora, right? The people who have left for economic or psychological reasons, really, and don't want to rebuild. You know, there's a bunch of those in this film, too.
Well, it happened immediately. You could see it. I mean, we interviewed people in camps in the Red Cross area and so forth. They were fascinating, and they felt like they wanted to try to hang in and return. But, you know, we were coming through there sort of every 2 weeks with camera crews and touching base with people. And so many people just evaporated. But you know what I found?
Yeah.
The people who were showing up at the events, whether it was a memorial service for the town, whether it was the Christmas tree lighting or their Gold Nugget Day, which is a town parade and a celebration, those were the people who I think were doing the best based on my observations and the people we were following.
Last question, and it goes to the title of this film, Rebuilding Paradise. They are, right? That's just a fact. We are rebuilding everywhere in this country that gets wiped out by natural disasters. The question is, to you, as a guy who made this film, who's thought about this a lot and who has a platform, should we?
Oh, well, I believe so. I mean, I certainly believe that they're in Paradise. They need to build wisely. Look, when you pull this rug out from under people, it's not just about their living or dying in that moment. They are no longer saving for their kids' college fund or their business they want to build. These people, I think, offer a very inspiring case study in problem solving. I was really amazed that they accomplished what they did. I wasn't sure that that title, Rebuilding Paradise, was going to be viable in the end when we first started and 3 and 4 months into the production. And they made it so through that sort of unwillingness to say no and that pulling together to make good things happen.
Just like you said, it's a film called Rebuilding Paradise. I think the title actually works myself. Ron Howard with Imagine Documentaries, also National Geographic. Mr. Howard, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
A pleasure. A pleasure. Thank you very much.
On that note, by the way, about the title of that film, since the fire back in 2018, more than 1,000 building permits have been issued in Paradise. More than 250 homes have been built since. This final note on the way out today, a sign perhaps of these coronavirus times and how so many of us are getting so much of our stuff delivered. Amazon reported quarterly profits after the bell today, almost $89 billion in revenue in 3 months. 3 months. That's like oil company money from back in the day. $5 billion net profit, a tad more actually. Amazon shares, as you might expect, up almost 70% for the year so far. Okay, we got to go. On this not great day for the American economy, the Dow Industrials down 225. That's about 0.8%. The NASDAQ up, though, 44 points, 0.4%. Tech companies there, the aforementioned Amazon among them. The S&P 500 down 12, about 0.3%. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.